Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And I've been asked, once in a while I ask some of my friends what a good topic would be. And I've gotten a lot of great ideas, most of which I've done before. I don't like repeating topics. But one of my friends on Facebook said to go back to basics. You're dealing often with very difficult material. How about the basic sense of what this all is? The Orthodox Nationalist is essentially a Russian Orthodox lecture series. There's no such thing as abstract Orthodoxy. It's always something. There's that something is linguistic. Language is really the center of a nation. Language doesn't refer to just words and syntax. It refers to all of the modes of communication, the whole set of symbols and meanings and the whole network of understanding that makes a nation a nation. You can't do anything unless you understand one another. And that's just not speaking the same language in the restricted sense. It's also having the same moral foundation. This is, any civic action at all assumes that basic moral agreement. We're agreeing on most of the same goals, the same general view of the world, the same general religious foundation, and we all speak the same language in all senses. Otherwise, there isn't debate. There are simply armed camps. The only thing that's kept the American experiment going is credit. And since World War II, the American has faked this kind of prosperous existence while building up, now coming up to $20 trillion of debt owned by foreigners in some cases. When that comes crashing down, any loyalty to this very artificial country will disappear. My personal opinion is that the best thing that could happen is that it break down into its constituent units. It would be the Pacific Northwest and New England, etc., the South. And then they could actually function as nation. But in no way can you have any civic life without unity in language. So in essence, I'm really talking about a unity of religion or the basic moral concepts. And, why are we here? What is our mission? What is our struggle? Why do we get up in the morning and fight? What are we willing to die for? We might like things, but what are we willing to die for? So, talking about basics, what is a Russian Orthodox nationalist? Why do I care? Why is it so important? Why is it so important that I have dedicated my entire life to it? My personal opinion, without a vocation, you can't be happy. Vocation comes up in Russian philosophy, Ukrainian philosophy. I think I've mentioned this before. I'm going to mention it again. The key to happiness in these systems is to find that method of contributing to the whole. And that means a vocation. Vocation is not a job. It's not a career. It's something that makes you you. One thing that you'll be poor in order to keep, that you'd even die for. It has to be something you're good at. It has to be something that contributes to the whole. Has to be something needed, and something that drives you. When you find that one thing, you're happy. You will live in poverty so long as you're still fighting. There can be no alienated labor if you're doing the work that you love and you are meant to do. It's a solution to social problems. And a society based on, guilds or syndicates representing the different areas of life, agriculture and mining and heavy industry and sales and every area of the economy and life you can think of, and people within it with the proper vocation. That goes for society, it goes for the individual. And I've been blessed to, and I mean that, I don't use that phrase very often, but I have been blessed to live this life, I believe, freer than most people, because I am not subject to a boss. I say what I please. I'm autonomous in the sense that self-interest and passion doesn't drive what I do. The minute you center yourself, the minute you want, what if the boss says, what if my wife says, you know, you're in trouble. Freedom is only to be found in autonomy. You can't just do whatever you want. It has to be a rational and civic mission. If you're enslaved to your passions, you're by definition not free. Now, getting to the essence of the matter, there's only one thing to do, and that is to go to the Slavophiles. 19th century philosophical movement, only occasionally referenced in Western writing, and like everything of value, have been butchered by American academics and churchmen. The reason it's been butchered is because they don't understand Russia, they don't understand Orthodoxy. Secular academia knows no loyalty, they know no friendship, they have no, at least white people have no civic connection, no national connection. They're purely self-seeking. They usually live in cities and are forced to conform to a very unimaginative, prosaic, liberal life. They don't know what religion is, let alone Orthodox. Trying to study Russia, like idiots like Gary Hamburg at Notre Dame, trying to study Russia without Orthodoxy is kind of like, you know, studying Tibet without Buddhism. This doesn't make sense. Studying ancient India without Hinduism. So when they get to the Slavophiles, I mentioned Gary Hamburg only because, I mean, the man's an idiot. I've heard him lecture before, and it's this plodding style. Tried to write a book on Russian intellectual history, and it's an utter disaster. And all he does is use Western terms to describe non-Western phenomena. In other words, he's going to impose Western liberalism on anything and everything he can. And so it's butchered. You read that book, you know less about it than you did before. But the Slavophiles are at the core. Very few people understand it. Very few people can really dig their teeth into it because they're part of this secular liberal academic life. They're nominalists. They don't believe there's any universal truth out there. And we don't even have the means to express it if we knew it. That means the only thing that matters is power, namely theirs. And ultimately, they simply don't care. So long as the gig that they have is not effective. So in getting back to basics here, the Slavophile is an unfortunate name. It just means someone who loves the Slavs, which is very, very kind of an odd thing to call this. But it is the central counter-revolutionary movement of the mid-19th century. Counter-revolutionary in that it opposed the Petrine state. I've made it a huge part of my work recently, last 5 years, 10 years or so. Try to explain that the Petrine movement, the 18th century in general, was a revolution, just as violent, just as totalitarian as anything that the Bolsheviks ever put up. There was kind of a veneer of Orthodoxy there, but that's all it was. Orthodoxy was to be found in the Old Believers. And Old Believers come in all shapes and sizes, all over the place. So many of the so-called priestless, those without priests, come from the north where they had very few priests to begin with. It's not so cut and dry. Oftentimes, Westerners want to put labels on things, and putting labels and saying this in a lecture or something like that, it really doesn't require knowledge. Throw a label out there, it sounds like you know something when in fact you don't. If there's one way I could describe the Slavophile movement, writers like Aksakov and Samadin and Komiakov and these others, lay theologian, Ivan Karisky, the philosopher of the group, is that our inner state is far more important than external legislation or formal law. The concept is, and I think it's common to a lot of traditionalists, thinking. If a law, especially one that, you know, covers something, you know, family life or social life, if there's a law written down and has to be enforced by coercion all the time, society is already decayed. When a regime has to rely on coercion, then it has no legitimacy. All the law is, and that term has changed so radically over the years, the old definition of law is the same thing as justice. It's really a state of affairs. Law is not something that a legislature can pass or dream up and write. Language is very, very weak. I mean, they abbreviate far more complex concepts, much of which can't be put into words. So much of tradition is really, you can't really put it. That's why we have folk songs and poetry to try to fill that gap a little bit. The interstate refers to our control over the passions, the ascetic life in one sense or another. Anyone who's controlled by the passions and dominated by them is not free. They can't think straight because everything is geared towards gaining whatever it is that you want, whether women or money, whatever it is. Ultimately, it all comes down to women, especially in America. You know, American men buy cars and homes and everything else and spend fortunes, not because they really care that much. They want the Ferrari to show status, but why do they care about status? It ultimately comes down to attract younger and younger women. But that's what happens when you have a society that is essentially one machine that produces sin. And you know, most of us who are listening right now are born and raised and hardwired in its assumptions. So we have a much tougher life than those who wrote the canons, for example. The interstate is this war, this arena, where we fight the passions in the name of reason and spirit. They are related, certainly not identical. The outer state is the formalism, the external world, law, you know, governments, courts. The latter is really a last resort. When I first came across this concept in college, Edmund Burke, and it stuck with me, and it's always essential to me. External law is pretty useless. An external law is, you know, how often can, you know, law requires that most people accept its precepts and avoid doing the thing that's being legislated against. There's no way that coercion can constantly be used. If there becomes a problem develops, a law can then be passed. But if it relies on the written word, then the concept behind it is long gone. There can be no law in any sense of the term without that internal ascetic control. We live in America, and the capitalist consumer world has as its absolute central concept that the consumer buys and buys and buys and buys and buys, and that these objects and what they can gain is really what we're here for. That's what we work for. That's how we measure success and prosperity. This is how we were all raised. This is how, whether, you know, no matter what our parents said, this is how we were raised. And even in school, you know, prosperity means having more things. Formalism is the enemy here. A law is a state of affairs. The world is governed by natural law. The family, the hierarchy, the role of father, the monarch, as mirroring that in the state, these nested communities. There is no such thing as the individual. It's a pure myth. The individual is something constructed during the era of industrialism. Even our consciousness has shrunk. The consciousness of the Slavophile is far greater than the ego. We think of our own consciousness, which, you know, we experience immediately. It's hard to think about because it's always there as we're thinking about it. It's an object. It's a thing. It proves the existence of spirit because it is not physical. It is free. It is not based on purely cause and effect. You can choose your thought processing. Therefore, it can't be material. Therefore, it's spiritual, and the spirit must have an origin. Rejecting formalism, the point I'm trying to make is our consciousness in this era has been redefined where we think of our own field of vision in a community where generations have come to know each other and know each other intimately well, families within a commune. within an area. Their consciousness is more than just themselves. They could actually, you know, see themselves in the other person and think as the other person. It's hard for us to comprehend, but ancient medieval societies had this understanding. Oftentimes, the city dwellers in Russia said that peasants can talk to animals, that peasants, the animals listen to them, that they know in an intuitive way everything there is to know about soil, chemistry, and water. And they're often very taken aback by that. It's one of the things done, even some of the lefts in Russia. Alexander Herzen is one of these guys who rejected liberalism at the end of his life because he saw what the peasants were superior. Peasants knew far more. The city dweller is very restricted in his understanding. Everything is formal, based on the written word, and that means it's based on the deceit. Talmud is nothing but a way to make words mean whatever you want, to have a plausible argument that can support that. Of course, none of that works without power. Power and authority are two completely different things. Again, something common in all traditionalism. Power is mere coercion. It's to force someone to do what you want. In and of itself, it's meaningless. The fact that you have to use force means that either the person you're dealing with doesn't know what to do, and you know, maybe is a child or something like that, or that you have no right to do it. The right to do it is called authority. When someone says, I'm an authority in Russian history, what does that mean? Authority doesn't mean I have any power over anything. Authority is knowledge. You have the power, the terminology, the words and names of the history. I have an inner knowledge of it. So the difference between authority and power is extraordinary. In modern terms, those with authority have no relationship to power. Plato's doctrine of the forms is connected to the idea that, and this is Eric Vogelin's interpretation, which is something I mentioned before, the further authority is removed from power, the more that the forms, the archetypes, become separated from matter. And it takes a more and more sensitive person far outside of society. You can't be in society and see the archetypes, not in corruption anyway. To be able to comprehend, it takes a prophet to be able to see, a deep ascetic, to free himself from the constant flux of the will to power, can then see the archetype. In a healthy society, it's obvious to everybody, or almost everybody. The minute it's no longer obvious, you have a social problem. We're born and raised in the ideology of nominalism. It is a heresy. It is a root of all evil. It is a root of the modern world. You can't have capitalism, socialism, democracy, individualism, so-called free markets, feminism. You can't have any of this without nominalism. Nominalism says there is no universal truth out there. Those are just words and inventions. Hence the word nominalism, nominal, or word. That's all it is. That means truth is utilitarian. Ultimately, that means truth is power. It's one of the essential concepts of my entire career. And because of that, you can abstract an individual. The individual doesn't exist. It's been constructed by industrial society. If anyone denies that, they have to use arguments and language and logic and appeals that they didn't create. They have to use communal and actually very old historical methods of communication to convince me that we don't need those things. It's a contradiction. The ego, egocentrism, individualism, in the modern Western sense, is self-contradictory. But the individual is easy to manipulate. Communities are not. Remember, the worst times in Russian serfdom under Western rule in the 18th century, the only time actually serfdom became a real problem. Landlords, and you read this in really bad history textbooks written by Americans, that peasants, and they seem to imply that they're individuals making contracts with landlords. Well, that was never the case. Communes, often very large ones, negotiated with the landlord. They were equal partners. Now, Peter the Great attempted to, you know, change the balance in favor of the former. But they're dealing with traditional contracts understood by both parties at great length and in great depth. So it's not a relationship of domination. It can't be. The noble serves the state and will probably die in the process. The peasantry serves the community and the noble, making sure he has everything he needs. When Catherine the Great eliminated noble service, the system fell apart. The old believers understand the concept of the Slavophile, interstate, outer state, the informal versus the formal. The things that are formalized in words and phrases are a minuscule percentage of what we understand. Our loyalties cannot be summarized in words and numbers and computations. Love and empathy, humility, law can't capture any of these things. You can't legislate love or humility. The regime right now says it can legislate, you know, tolerance and equality. It's always been a weird thing because you need power. You need unequal relationships to enforce equality. Well, that's not really the agenda. No one really thinks about that. Voluntary consent. Well, what's consent? It's not signing a piece of paper. It's the historical tradition of a people developing over time. No different than a family. I've defined, and I've said this before too, one of the definitions of the ethnic group, the nation, are the structures that people have created in times of tremendous stress. That's why these, you know, folk songs are often very sad. Foreign occupation, famine, how people have adjusted and defended themselves in these times becomes really the essence of the nation. And this is what nationalism is, where they become the touchstone for political rule. Now, those have to be, by themselves, they're really not interesting. In a secular sense, they usually become manipulated by those in power, become a dead letter. Without the spirit, tradition has no purpose. I don't really care about nations unless the spirit is present in them. But they're not merely, we follow this tradition because it's what everyone does. We go to church because that's what decent people do, etc. Voluntary consent means that you use this language. The language that, you know, everything, how we communicate, and the signs and symbols that we use almost every minute of every day to communicate to others. It implies a shared universe of meaning, and that universe has to be national. It has to be ethnic. There's no other way to do it, because you can't have anything else. You can't have any political or economic ideology, can't be comprehended unless there is a common language in the sense we're using the term. Slavophiles make one general claim. That Russia can be found, I make the same claim. Russia is divided into two periods. Remember, this is the 19th century. Period one, Muscovite Russia up until Peter the Great, and then the Russia of St. Petersburg. And they're right to say that these are two different countries. Moscow represents the land, the tradition, the commune. St. Petersburg represents serfdom, slavery, and foreign rule. St. Petersburg is a Gnostic experiment. I've talked about this too many times to repeat it. And Peter the Great, as I'll say one more time, was an open Satanist. He worshipped Dionysius. He wrote hymns. I have written on this extensively. He wasn't shy about it because he marched around St. Petersburg with these demonic processions, with naked women, attacking churches. He did it all the time, drunk out of his mind. That's how this kind of the anti-subordinates, the anti-synod, the anti-council is to be found in Peter's processions throughout St. Petersburg. I mean, they rape people. This is the elite of society. And Peter the Great used sexual indiscretion as well as alcohol to control them. It was also a form of execution where he would force someone to drink himself to death. And many people in his entourage did die of this. They make a distinction between land and state. These are some of the terms that specialists need to know. The land isn't just dirt on the ground. It's never that. The land is, we think about even what if it is dirt, it contains the bones and the dust of everything that occurred before. It's incorporated everything. The number of people that have walked on, these have been the people who helped shape society. It contains it all in some sense. But it refers to the commune, the people, the nation. Back then, when anyone used Narod, the Russian, for people, it wasn't just, you know, any old group. It can't be translated as people, ever. Wishful thinking, they want to believe that they, you know, they're postmodernists, you know. Any people, it's not just random assemblage. There is no word for that, well, other than chaos. Only the nominalist, only the modern can you know, say, oh, people in an abstract sense, like there's an abstract man. Modernity is based on it, but it's a fiction. I've never met one before. There is no such thing as an individual. And the land is the commune. When a child is born, it is completely helpless and it will die immediately if it doesn't have a family around it. Now that in and of itself pretty much destroys the egotistical approach to things. Mother and father, the only natural arrangement. But of course, family back then referred to everyone. It referred to the extended family in the same place, interacting over generations. And they were joined into communes, and communes were joined into regions, and that became the nation. This was the understanding. And at every step, there's service. Suffering is a part of life. Suffering is not necessarily a bad thing. Suffering is what brings us to ourselves. The Petrine state was illegitimate. But when they make the distinction between land and state, they're making a distinction between Muscovite Russia and Petrine Russia. The state is an abstraction. State and nation are not the same, they're opposed. People refer to phrases like nation-state, which are a contradiction in term. The state is formal, the nation is the opposite. The state is the administration, the bureaucracy, of which the Russian monarchs were at war most of the time. There's one weird thing that Marxism has imposed on society, and everyone believes, that there's this ruling class in the medieval, ancient, and modern worlds up until democracy. The monarch and the nobles were constantly at war. Why would they cooperate when power is the goal? Now, the monarch already has power. He has no particular interest in pursuing it, except nobles believe that they deserve more than they have, and being forced to serve the monarch is humiliation to them, so they have to be forced to do it. This is simply because people are rotten. The health of the society can be determined by the amount of coercion that's necessary to allow the ruling class to serve the people, to serve the nation. When it's low, this is understood as something you have to do, society is very healthy. When you have to rely on constant coercion, society is largely gone. And there is no moral agreement, there's no common language, and society will fall apart. Or I should say, society has already fallen apart. Political liberty is not the same as freedom. It is vulgar to refer to freedom as doing whatever you please without any kind of external restraint. Only moderns could actually use a term like that. No one likes that. The last thing you want in any relationship is to have someone doing whatever they please. That's the last thing you want. Passions drive people. They drive them to do irrational things. Freedom must be autonomy because it has to be rational. In the Muscovite period in Russian history, the state was purely national. It was not local. The concept of governance meant national defense, taxes, religion. The Tsar was a religious, not a secular institution. Actually, there were no secular institutions up until recently. It was a religious institution, at least up until the death of Alexis. He was an icon. Everything is ritualized because everything is in accordance with natural law and revelation. We're essentially one and the same thing, using different language. The nation is a manifestation of the universal. natural law and the truth of the Orthodox Church, or the Christian Church, Orthodox Church, New Israel, New Jerusalem. These are international. These are cosmic. But that's an abstraction. The canons and doctrine, these are also abstract. They're written down only as a convenience. It's really a denigration, because there's a reason Christ didn't write anything down. Words are very misleading. They're constantly changing their meaning. We can use them, as you see in the Talmud, to conceal. One of my favorite Platonic dialogue is the Gorgias. It was my first ever philosophical text, my freshman year in college. And it was a seminal work for me. I read it even before, right after I read the Republic. That's not true. I read the Republic in high school. But the Gorgias, I was in a much better position to understand. The Gorgias refers to rhetoric. Rhetoric is, the professors try to teach this stuff like it's relevant, like speech making. Well, it's the rule of people who know how to manipulate the masses. Think of it like that. So Socrates is talking about something we talk about every day today. If you believe that there is no truth, if you're a nominalist, then the only thing really is going to matter is power. But power is tricky because you have to convince people that you should have it. You know you shouldn't, so you have to manipulate them, and you need public relations. That's what they mean by rhetoric, speech making. And usually this dialogue is taught, kind of condescendingly. Well, those poor people, that's all they had was speech making in court. But that's not what he meant. He's talking about this huge, with someone, if you're in power, you have no right to be there, and you know that. What do? Well, you could resign, or you can do everything in your power, narcissistically, to try to convince people you really belong there. The term hypocrisy doesn't mean inconsistency. Be very careful. Hypocrisy means preaching something that you don't believe. We're all inconsistent. But to be hypocritical is to do or say something that you don't believe is true. You have to do it because of your position. And this is what illegitimate rulers do. This is why whore politicians, really have very little power, tell different groups of people what they want to hear. This is rhetoric. This is speech making. Has nothing to do with actually literally making speeches somewhere. It's public relations in all its terms. This is the very concept of the perversion of language. If we're not in agreement on what these words mean in depth, words like law, constitution, truth, etc., that means a skillful orator, in all senses of the term, can make it be whatever he wants. And of course, it's always going to be something in his interest. The more corrupt society is, the more power orators have. Now, it's a very awkward way to put it, but oration is the same thing. It's public relation. A contract is not an abstraction. In modern terms, there really is no legitimate contract, because in no way can this isolated, alienated individual make a contract with Microsoft as if they're two equal parties. That's laughable, especially as the economy is heading into deeper and deeper depression. It's absolutely absurd. You are an insect to Microsoft. They brought the Justice Department to its knees 20 years ago in their antitrust suit. They proved, and this was seminal for me too, they proved that the private sector is far more powerful than the state. Bill Gates had more lawyers, had more money than this broke, bureaucratic Justice Department. And they made a secret deal, and no one said a word. But it really was symbolic in a very real sense, and meant to be symbolic, that this is an oligarchy. The state is nothing more than the bodyguard for the oligarchy. You can't talk about politicians like they have anything. Politicians, and I'm going to say this now, I'm going to have to say it again. Politicians, the state, the presidency, have no relation to the economy. They can't control it. They can influence it only indirectly through taxation. And that, you know, has been relatively stable over the years. There may be small adjustments, like capital gains or something like that, that a politician can actually make a difference over a long period of time. One of the reasons I refuse to vote is that there is no relationship between voting for someone and public policy. Politicians, when you vote, you're assuming that this person has power. That voting doesn't change things. Voting elects a politician that can change things. They can't. And always remember, a president can't pass laws. He can't have an agenda. He might suggest things, but all he can do is enforce laws that Congress passes. This is all extremely relevant to what we're talking about. You know, the idea of westernization in Russia, or liberalism, as it dissolves social bonds, it says that the nation is a figment of our imagination. The international community, though, is real, and the individual is real. You know, but the nation seemingly has been accepted as this reality when in fact it's not, according to them. But of course, their policies are slowly eroding its foundations, so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They corrupt the population, and when they behave without morality that they see, morality is all relative. See how people behave. We come to understand universals through experience. In theology, angels know these intuitively. They don't have to go through a process of learning and understanding like we do, going from the particular to the universal. That's backwards. Adam and Eve they knew things intuitively. They weren't all-powerful, and they weren't perfect, but they were innocent. The use of concepts, words, definitions, equations, is a result of alienation. We're one step away from reality. And one of the problems there, as you step away from intuition and you're forced to use words and concepts and then explain that to others, you're now three steps away from reality. And this is why words can be manipulated so easily, and this is why Plato's Gorgias is so extremely important. And he makes the point, ultimately, that as such, you have no real purpose as an orator. We say this to lawyers all the time, you're a whore, you're for hire. You do what you need to do, what you're paid to do. And you can accept this because there really is no truth. So who cares? If it pays, the check's clear, I'm good. They're intersubjective, but it doesn't mean that they don't actually exist. Folk life, national life, expresses universal truth, but in a way that we can comprehend. I came across someone I respect, making an argument that Orthodoxy can never be actually national, because we accept people no matter what their DNA is. This is Father John Whiteford said that, a guy who I like many other respect. And I said, what a colossally stupid thing to say. We accept people no matter what their DNA, as if we're pushing people away based on DNA. It's rhetoric, it's juvenile. I'm not even talking about individuals. Folk life is a national life. He belongs to a church called the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia. Then denying national life. This is what's out there right now. This is this new breed. Father John, helped me in my conversion many years ago. He may regret that, but he's written a great work. But taking this completely and having to use this juvenile language shows that, you know, he has to force it. The essence of the nation is suffering. It is the life of a people over time. The church has to be national because you couldn't talk about theology unless it's national. He made the argument that Byzantium didn't make any special arrangements to divide people ethnically, which is a very weird goalpost set up. I think what he's referring to is that the city, Constantinople, had all kinds of many, many different languages there. Well, that's not important. It just means that it's a very important trade center. Then I think it kind of meant that the empire has nations within it. Well, so what? The concept of the term political exchange. The empire was not particularly important in the life of nations, except in taxes and self-defense. Otherwise, everything was local. You didn't have this all-powering state back then. You didn't have the technology to make it work. They didn't make any special arrangements. It is very strange. They certainly didn't integrate, though, either. And it doesn't matter, because the official language of the empire was Greek. The laws were published in Greek. The church chanted in Greek. That is not a coincidence. Everything is national, and that's it. Borrowing from other people. A nation being influenced by others has been used as an argument against nations. Well, we borrowed this concept from Indians, therefore, we're a multinational society. That's like saying, because I'm influenced by a particular writer, I'm no longer an individual. That's an idiotic thing to say. They create these goalposts. That's completely self-fulfilling. So when we refer to the nation and nationalism, we're referring to language. Language in this very broad sense. I must have said this 1,000 times. And I guess no one listened. That's what we're talking about. When I'm talking about states, in a sense, we're not talking about administration, bureaucracy. We're talking about the justification of these things. I'll say it one more time. There is no such thing as an abstract Christian. It doesn't exist. There is no abstract orthodoxy. It has to be embedded in a particular group of people because they have to understand it that way and then apply their own experience to it. And this is why different nations have their own sets of saints. They like that because these saints have developed according to national norms. Small nations versus large nations. Nations under foreign occupation versus those who've been dominant, etc. It changes how the church functions. The enemy of nationalism, the enemy of monarchy, monarchy has to be national by definition, even though other nations can exist within it. But they're understood as separate nations, independent in usually every way except foreign policy. But you have, yeah, the nation is centered completely and entirely on tradition, the tradition itself. We refer to that term. We are talking about language in this broad sense. And language reflects the structures of survival, as I've already described them. The culture, the nation, are one and the same thing. They are organic. They develop slowly over time, just like the individual does or the family does. States are mechanical. The nation is confronted by imperialism. Imperialism is a problem only because nations are being dominated. They're not being permitted to grow and develop according to their own inner light. They're being dominated by a foreign power. If nations don't exist and don't matter, then there's nothing wrong with imperialism. Aksakov talks about the notion of this the non-Aryan, the non-European concept of Moloch, the domination of money and power, and the human sacrifice that goes along with it. Its consequent in Europe is the rule of the ego. The rule of the ego is the same thing as oligarchy because only those with money and power can actually have their ego matter to anybody. Oligarchy is a conquest. It's pretense over knowledge. It's rhetoric over actual thinking. A society is no different than a nation. A people, society, nation. There's no abstract society. Therefore, they have to be national. It is a union in a common faith, belief, and moral idea. You can't talk about politics without telling me why it matters. Who cares whether people are happy or not? Who cares whether people are pleasant to others and respect the rights of people? Why should that matter? Why should that even be a good thing? You have to explain, ultimately, why we're here. And the ultimate goal of all human beings, which ultimately is a religious and moral idea. That means all politics is religious. Principles of Russian History by Aksakov. That's a great mission of Russia, is to integrate all social forces. This is the ultimate concept. You see this in Baran Bosunket. You see it in George William Frederick Hegel. That you have to have a single principle by which you integrate all the forces of society. All the different functions and vocations need to have a common ground, or else they have no reason to cooperate. Obviously, they have to have one common language, or they can't cooperate. The mission of Russia, though, is, and we actually, you know, what he's trying to say is not just in the society, but in the person. Boston Kidd also says this, that the individual, in order to be, you know, what you say once someone has integrity, what does that mean? Usually it means that they're honest or something like that. That's not what it means. Integrity and integral are the same word. It means that the personality has taken all of its component parts, that be our work life, our family life, the art that we like to watch, stuff like this, and combined it and integrated it under a single idea. Otherwise, you have somebody who simply, you know, has one personality for the boss, another personality at home. They have no real identity. They have no real purpose. They just mirror what's in front of them. They become nothing. They become a cipher. They don't become even a real person. What is that inner core? This is the person. What is the inner core? That's the nation. It's not hard. And ultimately, they're both religious because they both have to do with consciousness, which is both, which is absolutely completely immaterial. And we're talking about the ends of life here. The concept of the soba, very few people comprehend this and talked about it with any authority at all. This is one of the first concepts that someone studying Russian philosophy comes across. It is not a council. The council is a completely different thing. Council comes from the curia, comes from the those who are under the control. You know, a council is a papal idea. That's a council, you know, prior to Vatican II, they had no power. Only the Pope has power. A council is just to get the sense of what people are thinking and doing and to, you know, get consent, you know, to make sure that imposing something is not going to be a problem. The Pope could fire every cardinal tomorrow and they have no recourse. It's not a council. When you and your friend, say your wife or husband, something like that, are finishing each other's sentences, you've heard that phrase before. That's a little glimpse into what subordinates did. How well does someone know you that's known you since birth and has lived in close proximity to you? Now you multiply that in a family, and then you multiply that in family embedded in society. We can't comprehend it because we don't usually live in one place for more than a few years. That was unthinkable even 80 years ago, 100 years ago, let alone in the ancient or medieval world. Not only did you know each other from birth intimately well, but you have through generations. Political theory up until 100 years ago was prefaced on the idea, maybe even, you know, less than that, was prefaced on the idea that people in this community have known each other intimately like that over time, over generations, without moving. We can hardly comprehend what that's like. Representation, we read the anti-federalist papers, for example, in American life. Representation implies that people know each other that well. They pick one of their own and send them to Congress. That's the point. And it can only be free people. People talk about white landowners, like this is a big problem. They're not talking about landlords. Jefferson defined freedom as the man, rational man, who owns his own land and therefore is not subject to a boss. He doesn't have to worry about what he says. He doesn't have to worry about getting fired. Being a wage earner was the opposite of freedom. Only recently has it become respectable. It was never, it was considered one step above slavery. You have no freedom because you could be fired for any reason. Debt, up until, you know, 40 years ago, was an insult. Having debt is a failure. You're not even a man. You are a slave to someone until that's paid off. They have control over you. Now everyone has debt in huge amounts, so the regime has made sure that we think it's this respectable thing that everyone has. You forget what this means. These terms have changed radically over time. You can't have debt and be free. You can't be subject to a boss and be free by definition. And you certainly can't be free if you're worried about what everyone else thinks when you speak. And that gets even worse when what people think can immediately impose itself on your economic or family life. There is no freedom there. When you add debt and the rule of images, you're talking about not even a person anymore, because the rational faculty has been so stunted by that kind of existence. You're now getting to the point where you've now passed under human. And some of the people who are like that are those who rail against it. This is the core of what Slavophiles are talking about. You find this in different societies in different words, but it's the same concept. Freedom belongs to a handful of people, not only because of the economic factor, but because to be free, you have to be completely rational and objective. You have to know a lot about the decisions you're going to make. You have to have time and peace to be able to rationally go through possibilities in depth, consult others, elders, for example, have done it before. You have to make sure that self-interest, that anger, are not involved here. The minute they are, it's not a free decision. It's not a rational one. Then and only then can you act. And that becomes a free act. Otherwise, it is not. It is an unfree act. So defining it like that, and very few people would deny that, unless you believe that, you know, it's doing whatever you want. But if you deny it's doing whatever you want, then what I just explained there is the autonomous action. A tiny handful of people are capable of that. And it's getting worse and worse and worse over time. This is the foundation for aristocracy. That's why it came into existence. It had its military aspect, but then it also had its cultural aspect. The rational person is free. Now, I'm not talking about someone who justifies what they do. We use the term rationalization. That's part of oratory, as Plato would say. That's myth-making. It's telling someone what they want to hear, including ourselves. If our reason is being used to justify our impulses and our drives, it's not really reason. It's just hiring a lawyer to get you out of trouble. This is what Plato was taught. That's how relevant Plato is. And I hear him butchered by university professors every day. I have to make sure to tell them, Plato's talking about you. He's talking about you. You are bureaucratic. You're conformist. You're stagnant. You're self-interested. You are the very definition of unfreedom. So you get up in front of a class and start talking about Plato. You don't realize that he's given you the finger. You're the problem. It doesn't just mean everybody else. He's referring to you. And this is what Gogol, at the end of The Government Inspector, has the protagonist looking out at the audience and says, we're talking about you. It's you. Don't think you're absent here. This is about you. No one wants to believe that they're unfree. No one wants to believe that they're the problem. But those elements will make it unfree. Those elements are the very essence of what it is to be an American today. A good American is an irrational consumer loaded with debt that thinks that this is, you know, freedom. These terms have been so ripped apart and hollowed out that having a conversation is impossible because we're not using the same language. We don't speak the same language anymore. The great Slavophile, Alexei Komyanko, talks about this foundational matrix of meaning. For guys like Alexei Losev, it's what myth is. Myth is this wordless existence that a society depends on for even basic conversation to take place. Only a tiny bit of it can be put into a dictionary and expressed. Essence of something we mentioned before, the essence of an object is beyond reason. It can be rationalized. Parts of it can be put in logical form. That doesn't mean it's been explained. The empirical mind, over time, has degenerated into, if it's not quantifiable, it doesn't exist. That's what the totalitarians say. The Sobor is the community, not the collective. It fixes our will and makes our consciousness more than about us. We actually think as another person. Organization proves that the society is falling apart. The fact that we need, you know, strict procedure shows that no one trusts anybody. Love is an epistemological and metaphysical category. when you can actually think like another person, in the shoes of another person, and sacrifice yourself for their betterment in that respect, that's a relationship of love. Now it's been so, it's almost embarrassing to use the word that way. It's been so, it's essentially Valentine's Day garbage. The same irrational impulse that has people, you know, buy and buy until they can't afford it anymore. The same irrational impulse that a man gets to buy a Ferrari because he wants to get younger women. It's the same thing that has, you know, destroyed the concept of love. Unless you are capable of sacrificing your happiness for the betterment of somebody else, then you can't talk about love. So how many people then are capable of love or freedom the way we've defined it? Are we capable of this? Alexia Comey quotes says, power itself is sinful. It is inherently sinful because it relies on blind coercion. So the concept, the basic Slavophile idea is that the community then has one as its head that it trusts and knows intimately. This is the royal house. The crown is an expression of the sobor in the same sense that an abbot is the expression of the monastery, and that ideally the bishop is to the diocese. These aren't individual people. There is no such entity as the individual. These are offices. These are archetypes. Fulfilling them is ritualistic. Ritual exists to ensure that a concept or a doctrine is not violated in the day-to-day application of it. It's extremely difficult. That's why it has to be, you know, it becomes a liturgy. Everything in old Russia was a liturgy. Everything. There was no freedom of motion in the liberal sense. It was autonomy, however. It was autonomous. Because this is a single community rationally expressing itself in this way. But for a concept to be put into motion is very difficult. It has to be ritualized. A ritual is simply unpacking the concept of a law or something like that, doctrine, unpacking it in day-to-day action. We may believe in something like equality, but how do you live it? That's what ritual is for. Knowledge of X is X itself. That's essential to modernity. The truth is revealed in the act, not in the concept. The first steps you can take in understanding things, the subject and the object are really one thing, seen from two different points of view. The modern mind sees this magician scientific establishment as somehow free from cause and effect. The word faith is the concept of intuition. It is not blind belief or obedience. No one ever believed that at any time in the world. And if it is something that's promoted, then the religion itself has decayed into nothing. It's blind coercion. That has never been the case. Intuition is to comprehend the world prior to its being divided up into concepts and words. It's better than logic because it precedes it. That's how the Slavophile is using the term faith. It is the intuition that Adam and Eve had prior to the fall. Power, knowledge, these are burdens. These are not right. The people who seek power are the last people who should have it. Kolmogorov sees the world and history divided two ways. Just like we said, everything is divided two ways. The mechanical, the vulgar, the material, the empirical, and the noumenal, the spirit, the truth. There's a tendency for ritual to be able to connect the two. But in Kolmogorov's thought, he refers to the Aryan way and the Kushite way. It's translated as Iranian in the textbooks today because they can't deal with the fact that he actually referred to Aryans. But Aryan refers to people, it refers to a mentality where the Kushite is based on organization, Aryan is based on community. The Kushite idea it's, you know, not necessarily referring to people from Kush, but it's a symbol. It's mechanical thinking, a logic. It's rigid. It's statist. It's pantheist. It's magical. It's ritualistic in the worst sense of the word. It sees money as a living thing. It's civilization, materialism. It's monumental. The Aryan is the opposite. It's organic. It's based on poetry. It's based on intuition. Nations are organic in this sense. The state, however, is not. The nation comes from experience. The state comes from the desire of the elite for power. The state exists as a necessary evil, just like the sobor bishops exist as a necessary evil. Village, guild, parish, monastery, state. These are what make up the nation, but they're not the nation as such. Faith is how he's defining faith. When you talk about the emotions you have and reading your own history, family history, national history, these can't be put into words. We can approximate them, but this is why poetry exists. This is why music exists, because words are a very weak thing. And the Slavophiles are the foundation of Russian traditionalism, and they developed at a time where society was being ripped apart in the Petrine world. Russia was irretrievably divided two ways, the old belief and the Petrine state. Of course, coming out as an old believer is very difficult, but at least in some ways, the Slavophiles were very, very devoted to them. The last thing I want to say here is about the old believers. 1971, the anathemas were lifted against them, both the Synod Abroad, the Catacomb Church, and the Patriarch of Moscow has said that the old anathemas are wrong. Sorry, guys. All the bloodshed, centuries of oppression. Yeah, we were wrong. Sorry about that. You know, it's it really shows you how the modern concept of the Sobor, the Council of Bishops, really how important they are, and how you can't trust them as such. If it connects with the intuition, the faith, the way that Slavophiles are talking about, it's true. It isn't true because bishops say it. For them to say, yeah, we're sorry, so the thousands who have been killed by our predecessors in the name of the state, Orthodox people who have been slaughtered, yeah, too bad, pass the cheese. Anyway, I've overgone my time. This is just a tiny thumbnail sketch of the Slavophile idea. And I will talk to you guys next time. Thanks.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioAryan.com.